You are listening to Tempest in a Stockpot. I'm Christine Bruce.
And I'm Brenda Barrett.
And together we're agitating for change in Northern BC. In this episode, which we've entitled Imparting Hope Through Action, we want to explore the question, what does food sovereignty look like? Our guests are Lori Gallant, the Executive Director of MASH, or Making Agriculture Sustainable in the Hazeltons, and Cameron Bell, the fellow behind Farmer Cam's Foods, a very popular stall at the Skeena Valley Farmers Market. Lori joins us to discuss a new project called Voices to Ventures, which addresses a very frustrating loss sustained in the north, that of our only poultry slaughter facility. Then Cameron will share his frustrations around the field of farming generally, and his determination not only to remain in the field himself, but his desire to entice more youth to farming, despite the challenges imposed by bureaucratic thinking. Time to check the pot and see what's cooking. Any farmer I've ever encountered views rocky soil as a niche habitat that reduces the crop to hardy, drought-tolerant plants. Drainage is a constant concern. The soil is often low in organic matter and nutrients, and it's difficult for roots to develop because they must navigate around obstacles, sometimes leading to peculiar shapes and stunted growth. Rocky soil is rarely a farmer's first choice. If you Google the metaphor of rocky soil in an environmental context, AI suggests that it represents a poor or difficult foundation for growth, development, or stability. Such a metaphor might be used to describe situations, systems, or ideas that are unlikely to thrive due to a lack of support, resources, or receptivity. While the obstacles that present themselves in the Canadian North can seem forbidding to the common eye, Northerners seem determined to make good use of what they have, following the philosophy, grow where you're planted. I've heard Indigenous elders refer to rocks as grandfathers who carry wisdom. They're considered ancient living beings that hold ancestral memory. And if you think about it, the adjectives we use to describe farmers demonstrate this. Their work ethic is dedicated, industrious, and resilient. Their connection to the land, rustic and bucolic. As people, farmers are described as honest, resourceful, patient. I've always thought it was because my birthplace is the Canadian Shield in Ontario that I prefer to plant my feet on rocky ground. But maybe it's something deeper and more profound.
Specifically looking to talk to you about the Livestock Processing Solutions project that MASH has taken up in the last 12 months.
Because our abattoir in the area had been shut down. So
exactly.
Yeah. What's the need it's meant to meet?
Our project, which we are calling Voices to Ventures, it's about providing some solutions for small-scale farmers that are processing livestock to provide local meat to the community. So what we're trying to do is address some of the barriers that small-scale producers are facing right now. And when we started this project, there was a big turmoil in the Bulkley Valley because the abattoir had closed for a couple months. And then when it reopened, it had changed ownership and they had changed the service levels they were offering. This left a big gap and really sent a tremor through the producer community. And quite a few of poultry producers decided that we're not even going to produce poultry anymore because there's no way that we can process it. Mm-hmm. We decided we don't know exactly how we're going to solve this problem yet, but let's actually talk to a bunch of people and figure out some solutions together. So that was our goal, was to identify who are the key stakeholders, talk to them about what possible solutions we could come up with that address their impacts.
Because especially if someone's listening to this that isn't a producer, mm-hmm. when you say small scale, what size are we talking that goes from small to maybe medium? Is there...
I Googled this the other day to see if there's actually like a legal definition. We're probably talking about, you know, like less than 25 cows kind of idea. It ends up being like a total weight of your animal's process, not the actual number of animals. So small scales, probably you're like less than 100 acres, probably less than maybe a combined total of 100 animals mm-hmm. because it's weight. And yeah, probably you don't have a lot of like on-site processing capability.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess you could even say it might be tied to how much revenue you're generating from your farm, mm-hmm. which is probably going to be, you know, less than 300,000. Mm-hmm. And so for MASH, like we even think there's like micro producers because some of us are like 10% of any of those numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, but still regulatory, you need to follow certain processing rules. Like if you think transportation costs and infrastructure costs to get your produce to processing, in a way, an increased percentage, right?
Because yeah, that's
you're
right.
Not I mean, distributing it across 1,000 animals, you're yeah. distributing it cost of traveling farther, but with less animals.
Yeah, that is one of the big challenges too. Is like the cost of getting your product to market in compliance with a rather long list of regulations. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem to matter what size you are. It's like one size fits all regulations. So
are you talking about both slaughter and processing?
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of places in town that do one or the other, but they don't do both.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then there's also marketing. There's so many stages to getting your product to market. I mean, as if it's not enough just to breed them and feed them and keep them healthy, then you have to get them to the slaughter and then get them to the cut and wrap and then go back and pick up your order and then do all the marketing and distribute it to all of your mm-hmm. customers. You know, a lot of people think that people go into farming for the lifestyle choice, like, yeah, I guess if you like paying more than you can afford to get your product to market, then yeah, I guess that's a lifestyle choice. And then also because so many people are adopting, there is an issue of cold storage. Mm. So even if you have the skills to slaughter on your farm and you have your right license, you might not have the right temperature holding equipment for that. So that is a specific barrier. The project is about creating a roadmap and a toolkit. So what we're looking to do is to make it easier for somebody that wants to start a new venture to address some of these barriers to do that. What are some of the financial pathways that you can travel down to support your new venture? What are the major regulations that you need to be aware of and how might they be changing in the next 5 years? Because that's important too. You can design a business based on today's regs and then they change next year.
Okay, so I guess the question is, what's happening now? Is anybody in the Bulkley Valley slaughtering and processing chickens, or is this all farm gate work being done now?
I think that there's a mix of small scale in your backyard DIY systems that are springing up and people that are traveling quite a ways to have their poultry processed. There's the Classen cabin, which is quite far east from the Hazeltons where we are.
But nobody in the Bulkley Valley is actually
not, yeah, no,
or their own,
yeah,
their own consumption.
Yeah, nobody is offering it right now.
Yeah.
It okay, so is, it's a void. But there's nobody that's legally processing for other people.
We have no abattoir for chickens.
Right.
Yeah. What are the key players, organizations, and institutions that maybe need to be involved to allow and enable for livestock processing in our region?
So as part of this exercise, MASH decided we're going to follow the pathway that people would if they wanted to open up a new abattoir. What would that even look like? So we looked up how do you apply for Farmgate Plus if we wanted to do it on our own farm, because that's kind of the model that made the most sense. And one of those requirements there is to get a letter from an abattoir that is operating within 100 kilometers of your proposed location to see how they feel about this idea. So we did that and we got a letter back and they were in favor of setting up poultry processing. And MASH had looked at that in terms of a mobile slaughter unit, which is different than an abattoir. We are looking at that. But what they told us is they would not support mobile or bricks and mortar abattoir for red meat. They said that they are not operating to capacity and that they feel that we would be offering a service that isn't needed. There's actually many variables that affect how many animals actually arrive at the abattoir. And one of them is, what is the market price for cattle? Right now, a lot of people are exporting their cattle, they're selling them to auctions and getting like super high prices for them, way more than they could get if they had them slaughtered locally and sold locally as food for our communities. So I think that's having a very big impact on the abattoir, more than, say, if Hazleton started up a service. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's a complicated business to be in. You're very vulnerable. It's hard to know what the right scale is. And on top of that, it's complicated by the hunting season. The hunting season's happening at the same time that livestock are ready to be slaughtered. So then you're like competing for cut and wrap from the hunting community. What we have been really interested in is, like, why does it all have to be in the fall? Like, how do you get to a year-round service? And again, that's where the cold storage comes in. If you're slaughtering like 2 cows and 5 sheep for your own family, and if you're hunting, like, you're always waiting till it's cold outside so you can hang your animals in cold enough weather. But for people that are hoping to move to more year-round service and have infrastructure, you're probably... Like what we learned in our surveys was about $30,000 was the average amount of money that people were spending to get set up so that they could keep their meat at proper temperatures. Mm-hmm. So that is a project that MASH is very interested in pursuing, because I feel like that's something a bit more reasonable that we can do. Right now, it's just more cost effective to just do things more in the natural cycle of weather patterns and not spend that extra money, especially given the high cost of processing if you don't want to do it yourself. And why should you have to do it yourself? As if it's not enough that we're all working other jobs off the farm, because you can't really earn enough just on your farm. And then on top of that, we come home and look after our animals and feed them. And now we're also expected to slaughter and process our own animals by getting this special license called Farmgate Plus. I think it's unrealistic for the government to think that farmers can do all of that stuff, especially on a small scale.
We celebrate a lot the like local food movement, and that the system in a way has gotten shorter. The field where whatever is being raised, carrot or sheep, to the freezer of the person who's eating it. But we've also made that such a shallow system that more of the burden and the responsibility is both on the eater and the farmer. Because you still need cold storage. You still need transportation to get it to the freezer. You still, all these, we can celebrate it's more local, but we still need more people involved in the middle so that the burden of all that work isn't on the farmer and the producer. So you're no longer only a farmer. You're the marketer, the grocery store, the butcher, and even the eater is having to figure out a schedule to get to the farm to rechange their infrastructure. And we have a local food chain more than a system,
I think,
which actually is not very sustainable or not very resilient.
Exactly.
Because there's not redundancy in that. Should one player, one abattoir, goes out of business, and an entire region is out of a service.
One of the complaints I heard in a meeting with Nathan Cullen was that the rules that they're imposing on the north work really well down in the mainland, but they don't work at all well up here. Would you agree with that?
Yes. That's a conversation I've been having with Don Stevenson as well for at least 15 years. He's our local Ministry of Agriculture. So it's a very strange system, and apparently the rules haven't been reviewed since 1993. Mm. But I don't really like the lens that they're using for reviewing this. I think the lens should be, how can we make a more sustainable food system? Not how can we address the problem in the Fraser Valley, where really rich people are buying up farmland and just have a couple of blueberry bushes, but to support small scale farmers and to consider regional variations in climate.
I was going to say, maybe it's an and, not an or. About spaces, even in BC as a large province, right?
Sure.
With a lot of diversity in there. And can we do and rather than always being black and white across the board?
If you look historically at how regulations governing meat production have changed, In 2006, we saw the first big change where farmers were no longer allowed to process meat on their own farms and had to go to a slaughterhouse. And then in 2021, we saw the rules change again to say, like, okay, farmers can process their own meat, but they have to have this special license called Farmgate Plus. And now that's all fine and dandy if you have the economies of scale and the financing and the time, or if you have abattoir, slaughter, and cut and wrap. But if you don't, then you're in purgatory, and these regulations don't make any sense.
And this is why people are so dependent on the grocery stores now, and why we get really pooched at times like COVID, because we don't have stuff coming up because there's no distributors traveling. It's not sustainable because we can't do it ourselves with all these rules.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, like if you want to buy like a 5-pound pork roast like I did at the farmer's market last weekend, it's like $50. Yeah. The answer that some people are proposing, like, we'll just eat less meat.
And there aren't all those options up here.
And there, exactly.
Well, and our climate. Exactly. You know, are we going to take up more forest in order to put in more soy fields? Yeah.
So it's a really complex issue then. Okay, you then. Just want to be able to process your chickens, but suddenly there are all these things that...
I went into this project with biases and understandings that were proven quite wrong. I really thought there'd be more of an uproar from the agricultural community about the abattoir closing down and the lack of chicken processing. We really thought that more people would want to complete our surveys and write letters to MLAs, help change regulations. But I think people are just feeling a little bit overwhelmed by everything that's going on in the world. It's just overwhelming. But what we are learning, people like the Sausage Factory and Skeena Meats, like, it surprised me to find out how much local meat are they actually selling. Because here they are, their local butcher shops. Well, it turns out the Sausage Factory is really only selling like one local cow equivalent per month. But really, their meat is coming from all over the province. Skeena Valley Meats, they sell chickens, but guess where they're coming from? Armstrong. Even though we have the capacity to raise meat here, the lack of processing is being reflected in what's actually being sold, not just in grocery stores, because we all understand how that system works, but the little local butcher shops that you would expect to have local meat don't even have it. And they said it's because the prices that the producers have to charge to cover their costs are so high that nobody will buy it in their store. But that said, I saw the other day they were selling this Wagyu beef. And it was like, you know, $70 for one steak, and they sold out. So like, how do I reconcile these two messages? Every farmer is unique and they have different needs. So this really highlights that there is the fallacy of the perfect solution. So no matter what MASH and the RDBN come up with, our focus is going to be on progress, not perfection.
Having completed several months of research and connecting with our local farming community, Lori, in partnership with Megan Darcy at the Regional District of Bulkley-Nechako, has delivered a toolkit called Meet You Here. I attended the soft launch of this nifty toolkit in early February.
Thanks for taking time today to celebrate the launch of meetyouhere.ca. This is a practical toolkit to help strengthen local meat ventures and our community food systems across Northwest BC. We're going to talk about the origin of the project. It was really a reaction to a bit of a crisis that we're having in our local meat supply chain around meat processing services. The whole slaughter cut and wrap piece created quite a bit of problems for people back in February of 2024. When the abattoir in Telqua temporarily closed. And it was kind of a no-brainer that we needed to understand the overall ecosystem, who are all the players in it, what are the strengths of our system, what are the weaknesses, and what are actual steps that we can take to make it better. And I guess the question was even more than that. What can we do to make it easier for producers and processors to succeed together? And that's why the toolkit became part of our project, because what we had been hearing over the many interviews and surveys that we did with players across Northwest BC was that they didn't feel like there was enough support, that it was kind of hard to find information. It was hard to find access to critical funding needed to take their enterprise to the next level. So our vision was just to bring everything in one place and provide like warm referrals and direction to resources that are maybe like just a bit harder to find unless you spend hours and hours like we have tracking them all down. So that's what it's all about. So at MASH, our mission and core values guide our decisions, and certainly like reducing barriers and creating opportunities for people in our food system is what really drives us. Megan Darcy is my primary partner for this project, and she's the agriculture coordinator for the regional district of Bulkley-Nechako. So the RDBN partnered with MASH on this because in addition to the toolkit, there was also kind of a broad capture of data across both regional districts, so both the RDBN and the RDKS, to try and sort of get a picture of what's happening right now in the livestock processing industry and with respect to livestock services for producers. So that was part of the project that I was most involved in. And I am very supportive of the toolkit as well, because it was one of the deliverables and outcomes that we had envisioned at the beginning of the project.
You are listening to Tempest in a Stockpot. I'm Christine Bruce.
And I'm Brenda Barrett.
In the first half of this episode, we shared our frustrations over a recent loss of our only poultry slaughter facility in the Valley. To address that loss, Lori Gallant is developing the Meet You Here project, and she offered some common sense, philosophical thinking on how bureaucratic, short-term thinking isn't doing us any favors. Up next, Cameron Bell is a farmer in the Terrace area with a popular stall at the Skeena Valley Farmers Market called Farmer Cam's Foods. At least, he was until he decided to take a year off to try to entice more youth into the field. Brenda and I will learn about his frustrations and his determination to get more people into farming.
My interest in being a farmer would have started when I was a young teenager. I went to school with people from farming families, like Central Ontario has a lot of agriculture, but farming was never really presented as a viable career path. And I still think that that's an issue, is that in our elementary, high school, and post-secondary systems, there's really not a lot of situations where teachers are encouraging students to look into being primary producers as a viable career path. I attended UNBC in Prince George for a Bachelor of Arts in Environmental Studies with a minor in Environmental Planning. And over 5 years studying environmental studies throughout that degree, I was kind of steering more and more towards food systems work and towards agriculture. Around 2016, jumped into agriculture full time. So I was in Ontario for a couple of years working with an urban farm doing youth engagement. It was called the Guelph Youth Farm, in partnership with the Community Health Center in Guelph, but also in partnership with an organic farm called Everdale. And then I also worked with my brother's Water Farmers Urban Agriculture Innovation, and they did urban agriculture projects ranging from green roofs to rainwater collection to aquaponics and hydroponics. But my goal was still to become a farmer. So the season after that, I worked with a organic farm in the Kitchener-Waterloo area called Fertile Ground. It was a CSA for about 250 members. We were doing about 4 acres of vegetables with a team of 5 people, significant use of machinery, a couple of greenhouses and high tunnels, and more food being produced in one summer in one place than I had ever seen before. Everything up until that point was just kind of dabbling and exploring. 2019, came back to Terrace, where I had already met my current farm landlords, John and Jacqueline Gagnon, at Hidden Acres Farm, and started setting up a lease agreement. And then 2019 was my first season farming there. And so started solo, owner-operator, sole proprietor, rented land, a couple acres of tilled soil and no infrastructure, and lived in a trailer on the property that summer. And then over the following 6-7 years now, building capital infrastructure, buying the tools and equipment that I needed, and building the farm into what it is today.
What would you say is your biggest challenge right now in Terrace?
I think the financial side of it is probably my biggest challenge. And so that is a combination of input costs increasing, minimum wage increasing, and the price that we can get for our vegetables, having a bit of a limit on it as well. Right now we're paying our staff $18, $18.50 an hour, and we try and make it a really positive work environment. But at the beginning of the season, you spend a lot of money on seeds and fertilizer and supplies that you need, and you don't necessarily have a lot of income until maybe July you're breaking even, and August and September you're starting to make a bit of profit once some of your high revenue crops are starting to come in. And we have had a CSA for 5 years, and so we would get a significant amount of money in the springtime and then basically burn that for the next 2 months until our sales at the farmers market and our other retail channels started to increase. But I've been fortunate to receive a number of different grants over the years. I was in the self-employment benefits program from the federal government in my first season. So I was essentially on EI collecting minimum wage for the first year that I started my business. I got some funding from the Small Farm Business Accelerator project from the Ministry of Agriculture, and that helped us build a greenhouse. So we actually have like a heated greenhouse, good insulation, ventilation systems, computer controls. I won a business pitch competition called Thrive North, which was run by Futurepreneur, in collaboration with Community Futures, I believe. So I got $10,000 from that in my first season, which it allowed us to build a walk-in cooler. So all these little pieces have been really important, but also I have a university degree. I've worked in local government. I'm familiar with bureaucracy and paperwork. And so I think for a lot of people, that can be pretty daunting. I do sell food to the privileged, and it's an unfortunate reality, but my job is not to provide affordable food. My job is to stay in business, grow food and be a farmer and employ people and steward the land. But I cannot take on personal responsibility for the market conditions that make it unaffordable for low-income people to buy local fresh vegetables. If I decreased my prices so that everybody could afford them, I would go out of business pretty quickly. The reality is that in my first few years of farming, I was either paying myself $0 or $1 to $5 per hour. If you factor in like all of the hours that I put in during the season and all the planning in the winter and all the work in the summertime, as I got to my fifth and sixth year on the farm, I was finally paying myself at the equivalent of $15 to $20 per hour. So I'm barely making minimum wage now, and that's after I've invested over $100,000 in capital infrastructure. I wish that there were examples of people that are farming full-time year-round and making a living off of it without off-farm income, because I think that it is just accepted in society that everybody has an off-farm job or your partner has an off-farm job with benefits. And I think that it's really unfortunate that our society has gotten to a point where you can't easily be a farmer full-time and make a living doing that.
My local farmers here in Smithers did some research because people kept complaining about the price of the food at the farmers market. They're more expensive than the grocery store, but they're less expensive than the organic section. So it's still very affordable. And the way we're talking here, it makes it sound like very few people can afford the food at a farmer's market, but that's not really fair.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends what you want to spend your money on. I mean, people spend money on all kinds of ridiculous things. But if you think that it's important to spend money at a local farm, then you can make that a priority. I mean, but I think it's also a two-way street. I think if farmers have this mentality that customers need to buy everything I grow, that is not a good business decision. As an entrepreneur, the farmer has to understand the customer's needs, and you have to provide value to that customer.
So with that in mind, do you think we should be subsidizing foods then?
Well, we already subsidize certain things. I think at a large scale, you look at maybe dairy, grain, think that there are already programs in place to help the larger producers. But in terms of supporting smaller farmers and subsidizing foods, if there was a universal basic income, if there was some sort of, you know, program where we are all making a living wage guaranteed as a society, like some form of socialism, then I would have the freedom to actually grow the crops that are really interesting to me, grow the crops that my customers really want. But I don't have that freedom right now. I'm locked in a capitalist system where I am critically analyzing how many square feet of each crop have been planted, how many dollars I made off of that crop, and how much money I can make off of each individual crop. And so I didn't choose capitalism. I just grew up in Canada and I'm a Canadian citizen, and I'm going to try and make it work here. And for better or worse, that is within the framework of capitalism, unless you start establishing cooperatives and community farms and like all kinds of other radical ideas. And I think that some of those would be really, really interesting to look into. But I think like one proverb that I really enjoy, I think it came from Africa originally, is if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together.
Community, not commodity. Is that one of the answers about bringing more community back into our food system compared to food being a commodity?
There are a lot of different ways you can approach it. One is from the worker co-op perspective or the owner co-op perspective. There's one in Quebec called Tournesol Farm. And I believe that there are 5 families in this project. Some of them do flowers, some of them do vegetables, some of them do seeds. They're all on the same land. They all have infrastructure that they're using in common. And they have systems and agreements in place there, but they're all on one common land base. And I think for them, that model seems to be working really well. When my partner and I have been talking about buying a farm, we entertain the idea of cooperative ownership or like a corporation with multiple shareholders. And that's not like our ideal for how we would own our farm. I mean, it's certainly romantic to just stick with the, you know, family farm dream, but it's beautiful in a lot of ways, right? Like to own the land that you farm on, to make a living from it, to work from home, essentially, and to be able to invest in the soil and invest in the ecosystem and actually have that enterprise and land base as the source of your income and your food and your livelihood is a really special concept. And like, I really hope that we can move towards that in the next few years. Within that, you could still have some sort of worker co-op or some sort of blended model. You know, there might be some other like hybrid models that you could look at. But I think for us personally, our dream is to buy a farm, to run a farm as a business within that space. So that being said, are there community-based models that can work and that we should be looking at implementing? Yes, absolutely. And you still need a farm manager. You still need somebody who has that attention to detail and the skills and the interest and the commitment to like work the overtime hours. I just think that you still need to have a couple of champions that are really dedicated to leading that operation. The last thing I'll say is around community-supported agriculture, which is in some ways like an informal produce co-op because you're putting money in up front and you're getting produce every week. Yeah, I really think that CSA models are a really exciting way to bring the community more into the farm. But the disadvantage there is that it requires your CSA members to have, you know, $500, for example, up front available at one time. Should we have federal, provincial, municipal governments investing in local farms that are growing food and sharing it to the community? Sure, absolutely. As long as you have a champion that's actually going to produce a lot of good food out of it. I mean, I think that community gardens are really great places for community engagement and social interaction and food literacy, food education, and a little bit of local consumption, but they really don't produce a lot of calories. You're not filling your pantry and your root cellar out of the things that you grow in the community garden. Like certainly there's some gardens that are very productive. There's some gardeners that are very effective, but a lot of the growth that I see in community gardens is just some flowers and like a bit of this, a bit of that. And you've got some bolted lettuce and radishes over here. And it's still a really great initiative. And I think that it's really awesome for people to have these spaces to go and hang out and learn more about food. But I think that if we really want to get serious about food security, about like actually eating local food year round, we need to have larger farms. We need to have people with the skills to run those larger farms. And if there's going to be some sort of government funding to make that happen, there need to be some standards and expectations around how much you're actually going to be distributing. And like, I think what Tea Creek is doing is awesome, but I think that they have trouble getting funding. And so like they are sharing food for free to Indigenous people, but they are doing that because they get a little bit of funding every year to run a farm and pay the staff. And that's always been tenuous for them, I think, is knowing whether or not they'll have the funding year to year.
If the system is still so hard to get into, land access is complicated, if you don't have the entrepreneurial business skills, is it ethical to be attracting more young farmers into a system that the majority of them will probably fail at?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the same question about whether or not you want to have kids, knowing that climate change is a massive challenge. What's the alternative? Like, are we just going to give up? Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think we should be getting more youth involved in agriculture. And I think it would be great if there were more farms that were employing people. At the end of the day, you go home with a sense of satisfaction that I don't think a lot of other careers can offer. You go to the farmer's market and just customer after customer is excited about the produce that you have and grateful for the work that you're doing. And You know, you take the leftovers to the shelter as a donation, and your CSA members are just there every week getting the produce, and you're sharing recipes, and you're just engaging with people in a community-oriented way that we are missing out on in so many parts of our lives. So yeah, absolutely. I think we should still be getting youth involved in agriculture.
A powerful project that was launched in 2025 called Rise Up has attracted the talents and time of Farmer Cam. While we haven't discussed it in this podcast series, we encourage you to visit riseup-phabc.ca to learn more. Cam is going to take 2026 off to devote his energies to enticing more youth to the field of farming. To end this episode, Cam makes the point that his taking a year off farming might affect the local food movement in Terrace. So Brenda puts out a challenge.
Yeah, I mean, I think it could be a really good wake-up call for people in Terrace. It's really comforting when you can go to the farmer's market every Saturday at 9 o'clock, and you can show up and you know that Farmer Cam's is going to have salad mix and lettuce. But if we're just not there for an entire season, I think it will remind people of how fragile our food system is.
It would be, I think the ideal world would be to have more people step in. And I would really like to throw that challenge out there to people.
RDKS should invest some of their economic development dollars into a campaign prove Farmer Cam is redundant.
Yeah.
See how hard we can make it for you when you come back.
Yeah. No, I mean, honestly, that totally kind of like keeps the fire under my butt, like make sure that I'm still hustling. And I'm like, okay, like Wes is going to show up with some good looking produce. Like I got to have a competitive edge here. And so that's, you know, like competition, capitalism, it can breed innovation. It can create this space where everybody wants to hustle to like survive as a business. Since Wes has shifted into more of a training and engagement role, he hasn't been like selling produce at the market, and haven't seen anybody else really showing up with bins and bins full of produce.
And as an eater, when I go to the farmer's market, that's what I want. Not that it's competition, but that there are more and more farmers that I can engage with, that I can say, "Ooh, you've got cauliflower this week." Isn't that what community is all about?
Yeah, absolutely. And like, you know, a customer comes up and says, "Do you have fennel?" And I say, "No, but Vicky might have it." And I think that that's really where the future of the agricultural industry in this region could go, is like, I do think that some people look at what I'm doing and they think, oh, Cam's already got the market on lockdown, like Cam's got a monopoly. And I don't think that's true, because there's so many crops that I'm not growing. You can find the economy of scale, you can decrease your cost of production, and you can make it economically viable to grow that crop. And like, I think that this is kind of another interesting theme, like the difference between these diversified farms that are growing a little bit of everything and doing everything very inefficiently, versus having a farm that grows five crops or less, but you have systems in place to grow those crops as profitably as possible. And so I think I would love to see a food system where each farm is only growing a limited number of crops or products, but there are so many different farms in the area that the customer still has access to all these different things being produced locally. You know, the CSA model is great, but it does necessitate diversity if the farm is growing all those things themselves. I would be open to running a CSA where I'm purchasing vegetables from other farms and redistributing them through my own farm, but there's nobody else producing different vegetables in enough quantity for me to justify that right now. But yeah, that's the thing. It's the logistics. Like, we have a walk-in cooler at my farm. We have the wash station where you have space to do like packaging of produce. I think a lot of people get into agriculture thinking like, oh yeah, you're just going to grow things and sell it. But it's like, you have to have so much ancillary logistics and infrastructure set up that, yeah, I think, yeah, if you do kind of have this like food hub model and you're distributing from that location, it can be really viable, and it can be economically viable for that farm doing the distribution too, because you are making a small markup on a lot of the products that you're distributing there. There's a lot of days where I would love to just have somebody else take care of marketing and sales. Yeah. And I would rather just be there with the plants. But, you know, I've also realized that I do enjoy the farmers markets. And so I think there's a special piece of the picture there too.
This podcast was funded by the Public Health Association of BC. Brenda Barrett is my co-lead and the executive director of the Storytellers Society in Hazelton. Technical production by Christine Bruce. Music by Elijah Larson. Our food advocates today were Lori Gallant, executive director of MASH in the Hazeltons, and Cameron Bell, the brains and brawn behind Farmer Cam's Foods in Terrace. For more information on this or any other episode of Tempest in a Stockpot, visit storytellerssociety.org/tempest. Thank you for visiting our local farmers markets with us. I'm Christine Bruce, reminding you to stir that pot and to consider the words of Diane Whelan, an award-winning Canadian filmmaker, who said, "We used to live in a society. Now we live in an economy." This is certainly evident with the conversation shared in this episode. As Brenda recently commented, a call to action acknowledges the rocky ground that the local farmers and producers in our community are working on, that there is much more to making Eat Local possible than the actual act of growing the food, and then to be part of the suggested solutions. Go on now.